Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is December 22nd, 2025, and this is episode 569. I am the ailing co-host Mark Ames in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd and please subscribe. And this time I can say I am on the line with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher. First time back live with Radio Warnerd. He's joining us today for this episode. John is in Lecce. John, welcome back. How are you feeling?
Thanks. I'm feeling a lot better. I have odd remaining symptoms. For one thing, I have what looks like a saber cut across the middle of my completely bald pate. But that isn't really the problem. I also have a big dent in my head that I didn't realize.
Wait, the saber cut is from the surgery? The dent is from the fall or no?
No, both are from the fall. The surgery was a much neater process. They buzzed a little hole in my head and fed some sort of cord in there, which had a suction apparatus for sucking up blood. And then they went way down to the bottom of my head. And I'm convinced, you know, when I fell in Moscow, that might have started it. Because there was a lot of blood and a lot of cavities that were handy for blood. And they drained that, and then they drew the little roto-rooter out. But the skull cracked from just, you know, falling on it.
The whole thing sounds very Dune, Lynch Dune. I don't know about the other Dune.
Yeah.
Definitely Lynch Dune. So I could just hear the little thing. God. Anyway. Tis the season. As I was telling you. So yeah, I got sick and I talked about it last episode from a salmon poke bowl. That didn't smell right, but I ate it anyway because I'm that smart. I'm now on day 11 of it, and I'm still sick. And today, finally, I got a prescription from the doctor for my nausea because I'm just in a constant state of waves of nausea. I mean, it's clockwork. It doesn't matter if it's daytime, nighttime. I've eaten or not eaten, among other things. And so I got an anti-nausea. You know, they have magical pills. They just don't give them to us. So this anti-nausea medicine that they could have given me a long time ago, but just gave it to me now on day 11. It says here, brand name Zofran, Ondensetron. It's given to people who have sickness from chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And all I can say is it worked. Like right away, suddenly some hunger returned. And then, you know, and you start wondering, why did they make you wait so long for that? And I went back to Wegmans and I went to the customer service and I said, you know, on such and such date, I got this poke bowl. I mean, I've been coming here for a while and it's made me sick and I'm on day 11. Like for me, going up one flight of stairs in my house is like climbing the fucking Matterhorn. I mean, I'm huffing from it. And I tell her that, and it was kind of like the scene in, I don't know, in Fargo with the smiling, I can't remember, was that like a fast food place? And Steve Buscemi is, talking to some helper somewhere, customer service, and she's kind of tilts her head and smiles. It's kind of what I got. Like, that's too bad. Oh. Like, oh, that's really too bad. I'm so sorry. Like, Jesus, man.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you could have at least refunded me for the, and I have no energy to put up like a fight.
No.
You know,
I have to say in terms of anti-nausea medicine, I'd be cautious with it too, because one of the horrible experiences I've had with medicine, and they are many, is from the days when I used to foolishly buy cooked chickens from grocery stores and drag them home to my lair and consume the entire chicken. Not surprisingly, this resulted in the occasional bout of food poisoning. And at one time it got so bad that I went to the hospital in the middle of the night and said, please, please help me stop this. And they gave me something that was called Compazine. And that was one of the weirder medical experiences of a weird medical life, because it gave me this this symptom that I'd never encountered before. Although when I mentioned it to a doctor, they confirmed it. Oh, yeah, that can happen. They called it agitation, but it's so much worse than agitation.
Is that like serotonin overload? Is that what it is or no?
I don't know.
Okay.
But you can't sit down or lie down or be still. Everything twitches.
That's dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very awful.
Yeah. No, I looked up the downside side effects, and it was basically what you're describing. Apparently, it's like a serotonin. It either ups it or inhibits it. This anti-nausea, somehow that works, but a potential side effect is potentially dangerous, like serotonin overload, I think they call it. And you can feel like you're going to burst out of your skin or something. And it would be, I've had something like that from an antidepressant I tried years ago, and it made me feel absolutely wrong. It sounded like that was what at least reaction was to it. Anyway, radio, sick nerds. Got us both.
Adventures in medicine. Not the good kind.
Nope. And when I saw one of the commenters said, sounds like you have parasites, not, salmonella. To me, I assume it's salmonella. It hasn't been specifically identified yet, but it just is... It is exactly like the salmonella I did have that was identified like 30 plus years ago, and that was treated with an antibiotic, and they just won't give it to me. They're just like, once again, they said, drink water, clear broth. I'm like, what am I, a fucking hunger striker? Like, this is day 11. And enough of our yakking. But anyway, it's really great to have you back, John. And now we have with us a great friend of the show, Anibale, to go into part 7 of our Operation Barbarossa series.
Yeah, I've been following Anibale and his tremendous series on the Barbarossa.
Tremendous is probably the right one. I want to specify, by the way, that I'm feeling absolutely fine.
Okay, that's good. Goddamn. If all three of us were bad, then Yahweh. I'm convinced this is Yahweh's revenge for something. But then again, when isn't Yahweh's revenge? Like from day one, it's Yahweh's revenge. He wakes up and it's his revenge.
That's true. He wakes up in a bad mood.
Yes, we are moving on, and I think this is probably the right time for a small recap. In the previous episode, Adolf Hitler decided he wanted to go to Soviet Union and conquer the whole land, but actually it's not just Adolf Hitler. Is Adolf Hitler and a bunch of army generals various economic powerhouses in Germany, because this is a point I've discovered I'm not probably explained really well in the previous episode. One of the reasons behind Barbarossa was the fact that actually the economical provisions of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact were extremely unfavorable for Germany. Because Germany was sending technology to the USSR, and the USSR was sending back raw materials, food, and things like that. But this created a very strong dependency. They were mm-hmm. depending. They were absolutely, you know, in a locked into a what could be called an equal treaties, where that, you know, USSR was getting all the good stuff, and Germany was getting stuff he needed to, because they needed to bypass the British blockade and feed the population. But still was a situation that was, you know, on the long term will have created trouble for Germany. So one of the reasons was that they wanted out of this. They wanted to get all the good stuff in Soviet Union and don't give anything in return. So they plan for this attack. They start the attack. The first two/three weeks goes incredibly well. And then the whole clockwork, the whole nice technological and ideological clockworks that is called by the newspaper, never by, not by the military, but by the newspaper, it's called a Blitzkrieg, breaks up around Smolensk. Why? Because he is a very fragile machine. Because is their provision that are being made and planning that has been made for this gargantuan attack over a front that is thousands of kilometers long with millions of people involved is something that is from the German side can go and work in the way Germany is planning just for few weeks. But Germany doesn't have the logistics, doesn't have the reserves, doesn't have the economics to sustain a long war. They have planned for a short war where the Red Army is going to be destroyed west of the Dnieper-Dvina line. And when they arrive to Smolensk and they are convinced that they are destroyed, the World Red Army, everything else is going to be, to use Franz Halder definition, railroad exploitation, they discover, lo and behold, that they have five brand new Soviet armies, not, you know, motley collection of Soviet soldier, but actual field armies that were well-trained and well-prepared, waiting for them in front of Smolensk, and the Blitzkrieg stops. What happens is that this creates this stopping of the Blitzkrieg and the fact that, you know, the idea of winning the world campaign in a few weeks begins to evaporate, creates this huge debate. One side, there is Adolf Hitler and the OKW, that is, you know, the joint military command of the Wehrmacht, the political command of the Wehrmacht, very faithful to Hitler, very dependent on him, that they want to, they're going for the economic and, you know, for the economic price. They want to go for Ukraine. Particularly because they say there's good reason for that. Because they need the resources of Ukraine. Because going toward Moscow with this non-stop resistance from Soviet Union may create a world danger. Because advancing toward Moscow, even if for some reason the resistance in front of Smolensk should collapse, they will have the southern flanks of the German advance threatened by this enormous concentration of Soviet forces in Ukraine.
Was there any consideration in any part of the German high command of possibly even disguised humanitarian effort?
No, based on not in 1941. Ukrainian? Absolutely. No, there was no thought of contained advance
on Ukraine.
No. There is Alfred Rosenberg and few people inside the Nazi polity, inside the Nazi party. There is a minority of these people. These include Alfred Rosenberg, Ribbentrop to some extent, few people on that side. They say we should try to concentrate on Ukraine and try to make use of Ukrainian nationalism in order to subvert Soviet Union and blah, 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 blah. But the military is overwhelmingly fixed on Moscow. Because they think, there are strategic reasons for that. Moscow is the major hub, railroad hub in Russia. Is an enormous, there was and there still is an enormous concentration of industries. Is the political center. So everybody is really obsessed inside. The military is really obsessed of going to Moscow because they think if we can conquer it, the wall. House of Cards is going to collapse, and they think it's either we go from Leningrad down to the Caucasus, or this war won't end. Okay, but what is the problem? The problem is that the military and the German military is thinking. In these terms, another victory and it's over. Another victory and it's over. They have absolutely no idea. And we are going to discuss in this episode a little bit of this very strange culture of the German military in 1941. This idea is that war is a sport where you win more, encounters. And at the end of the championship, you count the how many encounters you have won and the team that's won more. They see this like that. It's a culture. It's really a culture.
That kind of sounds American in a weird way, doesn't it? I mean, yeah. I like there's a sense among Americans in the Vietnam War, and then you saw it again in Iraq, that, wait a minute, this isn't fair. We won. The numbers show we won, so you're supposed to give up. This, like, it took years for them to switch to another way of thinking.
Now, Westmoreland directly said that. He said, we did not lose. They lost so many thousands of people that by any reasonable calculus— they should have conceded defeat, but they didn't.
It's exactly what the German military thinks. That's exactly the same culture, precisely. The German generals are soccer stars. They act, they think, they live like people. Be involved not in a war, but in a sort of world championship or whatever the sport, team sport you may think. It's incredible. I mean, there are some details of that have been discovered recently that are hilarious. They have fan mail. They answer to fan mail. They are, 10 years old children writing to them and telling, I saw you win the Battle of Smolensk with this unit and this unit. Can you send me a picture, a signed picture of yourself? And the general just stopped doing whatever he was doing. Okay, I'll write you down. Dear little German boy in somewhere in Bavaria, this is my picture, and thank you very much for being interested in what I do at the front. It's the same thing.
They love it. Nazi trading cards,
But they are fanzines.
Yeah, I'm Nazi not fanzines. Kidding. Yeah, that's right.
There are fanzines. People, particularly, and the whole thing is the thing that absolutely, you know, when I discovered that, say, I mean, I'm just dreaming. This is a little serious. Yeah. It's like there are trench fanzines. I mean, the phenomenon of trench newsletter, trench journalists is very old. It's not something typical of the German army. There were things like that in World War One. Every army had this sort of informal publication that were distributed among the soldiers. But there are publications that are just devoted to the fan club of Heinz Guderian. I mean, it's, oh, wow, Heinz Guderian, our leader, fearless leader of Panzer Group 2. And this is his picture by profile looking at west. This is picture by profile looking at east. And things like that. And it's...
And the generals loved it?
Absolutely. They live by that. In fact, they are so obsessed by the idea of popularity that at some point it's clear some of the military decision they do is because they think that this decision will make them more popular. Wow. But I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely not kidding. I'm going to... As usual, I'm going to put down a bibliography for that. You're going to read about that. There are documents, there are letters, okay, about the fact that they popularity and being popular with the press and being popular with their fellow generals and being popular with the party, with Hitler, meant for them a lot, particularly meant for them a lot of money. Because it was in an incredibly corrupt culture. We are going to discuss about this. But they were really vain, but vain beyond belief. And this...
Well, Eisenhower's comments on MacArthur...
Yes, I was going to say MacArthur.
Typical of that. Like he...
okay. In fact, the only two generals outside the Wehrmacht, I think they had this kind of culture where Patton and MacArthur.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, but this thing about media popularity inside the German army is something that is structural because every army, at the army level, is something that is only at the army level. So there are on the Russian front at the eve of Typhoon, we have seven different armies. Actually there are eight, including the third Romanian army. But I mean, German army, there are six, and plus four Panzer Group. Yes, the first, the second, the fourth, and the third. And at that level, they had what are called propaganda company. There are companies embedded inside each army that are just there to create, to promote the work of that army. And propaganda companies, PKs, are called PKs. Inside Panzer Group 2, that is called Panzer Group Guderian, the one, is probably the one that is doing most of the job. They even invent things like that at some point, Panzer Group Guderian, Panzer Group 2, is renamed Panzer Group G, because G is for Guderian. There is even a logo, a nice logo that is written. That is,
yeah, you need the brand, you need the logo.
Wow.
Okay, yeah. And... And part of the time, some of, not everyone, but the Panzer generals, definitely they do that. Part of the time of the Panzer general is used to promote this kind of thing, to think about this kind of thing, to make sure the public knows about their exploits. They write back to their wives saying, can you please control if special reports are normally either radio special reports or newsreel that are projected inside cinema. And they are very popular with the German public. There is a lot of the German public goes to the movies, not because they want to see because they want to see the newsreel.
Right.
The most important of them is called the Deutsche Wochenschau, the German weekly show. You can find it on YouTube. It's very easy to find. And people are crazy for that. They want to see because they are going to see. They are very well done. There are embedded cameramen with the troops that are on the front and they can film, very spectacular, very well-framed scenes of combat. And by the way, it's interesting because all those shows are organized in the same way. They start with something very light, like Austria, there is a new sport for the Paralympics, things like disabled soldiers are competing in a ski competition, so things like that. Or soldiers go to the circus, or soldiers go to the movies, or things like that. Or the population is right now involved into the summer harvest. Very light stuff like that. And then they move to the Western, like things like the U-boat or the Western Front, and again, very little happening here. And then they move to Africa, and the last part of the show is always on the Easter Front. Mm-hmm. It's always called on the Easter Front, and they see. Of course, the last part is the part where there are the scenes everybody's waiting for, because they're waiting, particularly in 1941. They think they're winning. They have been told by the propaganda. So they are going to the newsreel to see the German panzer troops crushing the Soviets and rushing through Soviet Union, and they will soon be to Moscow. And they are told every other minute that the one is going to be soon over. And on the last episode, I reminded that there is this big misstep that even Goebbels recognized on October 14th, when Typhoon is halfway through, there is this, the German official chief of press, that is not the same thing as Goebbels' propaganda ministry, is a different office, is a different branch, released this special news, breaking news, the war has been decided. Okay, Goebbels is the first one to think, well, we will have to explain to the public that war being decided doesn't mean the war is being won. Okay. But everything is very delusional, incredibly delusional. And you see, I saw in the letters coming from the Panzer generals that they are always lying to themselves. Okay, it's either, right now I want to, go back and drive all the way to Moscow, but my superior won't let me do that. And my other, my colleagues on the right wing, left wing, they are, incompetent, and they are letting me down. And then when the whole thing doesn't work, I told you so. This was my idea from the beginning.
God, this is like Twitter. It's like a Twitter feed on the Ukraine war or something. God, yeah. It's so familiar.
It's exactly the same. And another thing, and this will bring us to another subject that is dear to my heart. You won't believe the amount of classified and sensitive and important information these people, the German generals, write back home. I am in this city in the north. Wow. They are supposed not to tell anybody where they are. Okay. They are army commanders. Okay. See, if they have been killed is something important. My dear wife, my dear, Margarete, for instance. Well, Margarete was Guderian's wife. My dear Eva, that is Oepner's wife. I am in this city not far away from Leningrad, that begins with P. And then down, all the way down the letter. By the way, I was mentioning Pskov. Okay. Mm. So yeah. What the hell? we are down in ammunition, we are down on resources. Our left flank is very weak. Don't tell anybody. Okay. it's insane, because one thing, if their household had been compromised, it was a treasure mine for very sensitive information. Yeah. And it's interesting because it will give you an idea how class conscious, how unjust and how corrupt was the Nazi military culture. Because if a normal soldier would have written home, say, I am in Alexandrovna near Kursk or whatever, it would have been arrested or even shot, okay? Mm. But the generals, because they are not subject to censorship and they have private channels to send mail home, they can even phone home, which is absolutely... it doesn't make any sense, because again, you cannot use, there are regulations inside the German army about not using official army communication channel for personal purposes. And they do it all the time.
Wow.
You know, they phone home, my dear, I am in Smolensk.
Are they just not they're not being disciplined enough, or is it just the arrogance of we don't really have to worry, like the Soviets are such primitive monkeys, like they wouldn't even know how to tap on high-tech German phones.
Is one side that they absolutely convinced that the Soviets are, you know, primitive monkeys, as you say, and their realization they may, this may not be the case, is very slow. Very slow. Okay. And
by the fully evolved Ubermensch. This is very slow.
But the other thing is that being, you know, lack of discipline is a distinctive trait. I mean, Guderian, those few things that are absolutely complete insubordination. Well, at some point, the first case is Yelnya near Smolensk. It is being told by his superior, and the superior is superior, you don't have to cross the Dnieper and go to Yelnya. Okay, we know you want to go Yelnya because there is a hillside area. You want to use it as a staging point for a further advance from Moscow, but don't do that. You need to swing north and close the Smolensk pocket along with Hod. Otherwise, there are thousands of Soviet soldiers that is going to escape east. And he ignores, he completely ignores it. He say, oh, no, this is something that the infantry can do, okay? And it doesn't pay, they start to pay for that later on, when we're going to arrive at the huge Soviet counteroffensive in front of Moscow, because they start to retreat, and Hitler is very sensitive to that, and he start to fire them. But this is another conversation. At this point, these people can do whatever they want, but there is a reason they do for that. Because first is, of course, you know, the Iron Cross, Sam Peckinpah movie. Mm-hmm. I always thought
was a really good movie, I have to say.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, it's a very good one. I always thought that the idea of a German officer being completely non-stop obsessed just because he wanted to have the Iron Cross was some kind of cartoonish exaggeration. It's not true. They were absolutely, completely obsessed by that, because it was like, you know, winning a cup in a world championship or, soccer or basketball or whatever you
winning
want.
A trophy. I mean, that's
exactly. Yeah. But there were huge monetary advantages for that. First thing is that every army commander received personally by Hitler basically two times his normal wage, tax exempt. okay? Something that you don't pay tax. It's pocket money coming from Hitler, okay? Every month. Every month. Plus, they were given a provision to steal, literally steal, huge land properties, and particularly in Poland, in northern Poland, the area, you know, near Eastern Prussia. This meant there is this conversation that has been recorded by one of von Manstein's adjutants that he wrote that at some point in 1941, Guderian and von Manstein, they were chatting, and von Manstein, who was rich by family, so he didn't really need this. He received this kind of money, but was not really, it was a different class, okay? Told Guderian, I told you that you did receive this very nice property, land property, huge, huge land property, forest and hills near the Baltic. You received that recently. Say, yes, that's true. And but wasn't that property of this Polish landowner? Yes, is Guderian reply. And what did happen to him? And Guderian reply was, I don't know, I don't care. Okay. He was simply evicted and told, go away. Your property is now owned by this very nice German general. And so they were, you know, it was, they were not just, definitely they were not just do it for the honor of the German, of the German troops. They of course, they were all a bunch of Nazis. They were all absolutely in admiration. Well, Guderian definitely, Reiner definitely, they were absolutely in this sort of cult of how nice, how good, how Adolf Hitler is a genius, and the basic principle of Nazis are absolutely okay.
But really, when they got close to Moscow, Hitler started making decisions that a lot of the top generals seemed to find bizarre.
Oh, even before that. Even before that. I mean, as I had explained last time, turning south to Kiev was Hitler's idea. The general didn't want to. And then he managed to have Guderian coming to the Wolfschanze, the Rasenburg, the East Prussia headquarters. Hitler, his Prussian headquarters, coming to him, and he convinced him, you do what I say. Trust me, Heinz, trust me. I know what I do. You should turn south, and we're going to conquer Kiev. It's very important. You will see it's a great idea. This resulted in probably what is still considered Germany's biggest victory in World War II. And at this point, a lot of these people was looking at some level, particularly at the very senior level, not much at the Guderian Panzer General level, the level above, von Bock, von Rundstedt, the old Prussian military aristocracy. They were, you know, looking upon Hitler as a parvenu, you know, this kind of newcomer. And they started to say, no, he has a very great military sensibility, and they start to think is, but still, this doesn't mean they are completely convinced that Hitler whatever Hitler says is right. And in front of Moscow, when the huge counteroffensive that we're going to describe in a couple of episodes comes, all the generals, they want to fall back, and it's Hitler who is tell them, no, you don't. Step down, start to create these wave breakers. And these wave breakers help to stem the Russian offensive. And this is something, of course, you know.
Wave breakers? What? Oh, you mean wave?
Yeah, wave breakers.
What's a wave breaker?
Like, have you ever been? It's actually a term that is being used in military history. In front of on the coast in Italy, they are almost ubiquitous. You see, on the coast near the shores, there are like strips of rock that is being thrown in the water, and it protrude forward perpendicularly from the coast, and they break the wave incoming, you know, making the wave lose power, and so the damage that is done to the coast is less. They are called wave breakers, and the idea was the using Festenplatzen, you know, strong points, in order to break the momentum of the advancing Soviets. And they did that for most of 1944, 1945, with various success. Of course, one thing was doing it in Moscow in 1941, one thing was doing it in 1945 in Poland or Germany. But the idea of the wave breaker is something that, right or wrong, is attributed to Hitler. But Hitler was really obsessed by this thing in order not to lose, because there was a political reason for that. In 1941, when the typhoon falls, but even before that, the political situation in Europe is changed since the last 3 months. And in June, everybody wanted a piece of the Barbarossa victory. So you have Romania that is very enthusiastic because they want to, you know, get back Moldova and Bessarabia, and they want to conquer Odessa, and they are thinking about also, maybe they want also to conquer a piece of Crimea. And there is Hungary that want to have a piece of Ukraine, particularly of northern Ukraine. And there is the Slovaks that are there, the Slovaks, the Croats, Mussolini. And they are very enthusiastic for 2/3 months. And then at some point, particularly Hungary and Slovakia, they start to have problem with that. Say, are we sure about what we are doing? It doesn't look like the Soviets are collapsing. Maybe we are now put into something that is going to turn very wrong. And there is also one of the problems that Hitler is having is that he really wants to have a Turkey on board. And really on board, he would really love to have them join the Axis. But Turkey is really looking at it depends on what is going to happen in Russia, because if for some reason we enter the Axis and Russia doesn't fall, we are in huge trouble. Okay.
Yeah, the last time they allied with Germany, it didn't turn out so well.
No, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So they start to... So, and this is the reason behind Typhoon. After Kyiv, as John say, the most reasonable thing to do would have been to concentrate everything in the southern front, trying to push toward Rostov, try to have a good starting point a jumpstart point to try then to conquer Stalingrad, to reach the Volga, and then move to the Caucasus and get the oil fields.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you'd have fields and you'd have the coal fields and, you know, the agriculture
exactly.
down there.
Uh-huh. It's, okay, of course, I mean, I'm saying the most reasonable thing, but this is something we are saying right now in 2025. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have seen, there is a very interesting article that is written by a Twitter author, Big Serge, that is right. He's writing, I mean, has been writing some interesting stuff on Barbarossa. I don't always agree with what they say, but it's interesting. And he wrote a counterfactual history of Barbarossa, trying to describe what would have been the right thing to do for Germany to win. And everybody say, yes, concentrate on Ukraine, go to Ukraine. never mind about Moscow. But yes, this is something that is very easy to say right now. In 1941, Germany has a terrible intelligence, so they didn't know actually what about the real disposition of German forces. And the second thing is that they had this overestimation, non-stop overestimation of their own forces and underestimation of the Soviet forces. Every other minute they were saying, oh, they're going to collapse, they're going to collapse. The last line of defense is there. And the choice was between being 100% sure the war will have continued in 1942, going for Ukraine, but moving on in 1942 in a better position, or trying throw the final dice and try to go for Moscow, hoping for a collapse of the Soviet system. And there were signs. At some point in October, actually in late September, after Kyiv has fallen, Stalin started to move part of the government in the east. I don't remember the name of the city. It's near Gorky. Is somewhere near
Kazan.
Gorky.
So it's near Kazan. Okay.
And he started to move the diplomatic corps, part of the industry there, and the population start in Moscow start to panic. And there is going to be at this episode of 16 to 17 October 1941 called the Bolshoi Drop. Bolshoi Drop. Mm-hmm. The big scare. That is this moment where typhoon starts and everything seems the front has collapsed and everybody start to assault the train, try to get out of Moscow. And at some point, they have to tell the people, well, look, Stalin is in Moscow, he's going to stay in Moscow. Moscow is going to be defended, so don't panic. Which is interesting to say. you're going to be involved in an historical event, the defense of Moscow.
Aren't you lucky? But to John's question again, though, and this was something like, because I brought up the same thing kind of last episode, the other problem is that the Soviets weren't collapsing, right?
No.
So they were hitting back from the beginning in ways that the Nazis never expected and had never dealt with in any of their other campaigns since 1939.
Yes.
So if they tried to stop and consolidate, the Soviets wouldn't let them. And so the idea was, we have initiative, let's keep taking the initiative to try to bring on that collapse, which is the whole core of the plan, the Nazi plan anyway. It's going to collapse. It must collapse. So
Exactly. But this is the reason why the Kyiv was such an important battle from the German point of view, because the combination of the Western Front, the front, the Russian front at the center, at the area between Smolensk and Moscow, non-stop counterattacks in August and early September made, of course, the Western Front very weak at some point. And when the Southwestern Front did collapse in Kyiv, this meant that actually the defense line between Army Group Center and Moscow was weak. And so the rationale between Typhoon is that we know this part, the part we see of the front is weak, so why not attacking? Maybe this wall we see, the wall we have in front is breaking, and if we are going to break it, maybe, beyond the wall, there is nothing, there is empty space, and we can run to Moscow. Okay, remember, they have a terrible intelligence, and they have a very limited access to aerial reconnaissance on both sides. Both sides are the problem with aerial reconnaissance, because they, particularly Moscow at this point, has the most the strongest, the most complex anti-aircraft defense of the world. There really? Are there are British military attaché in Moscow. They say we haven't seen anything like that in London. This is our, I mean, it's something like a very integrated,
like a layer,
very complex layer of anti-aircraft defense. And the few times the Germans try to bomb Moscow, it's always a disaster. Okay, so every time they try to move and fly above the first 50 kilometers in front of the area, they cannot see anything. So they think, okay, maybe you have these few armies that we know they are weak because of the non-stop fighting in July and August and September. And we know that the Southwestern Front has been destroyed in Kyiv. So maybe, you know, another push and the war structure is going to be down. And, but what they fail to understand is that they have been telling themselves another push and the war structure is going to be down since July 22nd. At this point, they should have said there is something wrong with the war conception.
This is where, I keep thinking of something you've said in another context, which is that the Japanese high command had done a very careful study of the prospects for this war and told the German high command, you can't do this. You don't have
July 9th.
The transport.
July 9th. So, 1941.
Did they have any further communication with the Japanese high command?
Oh, yes. July 9, 1941, the military attaché in Rome sent a message telling there is no July 9th. This means that he's
this
the
is 8th, at the peak.
At the peak of this, he write down a message sending back to his to Tokyo in order this to be forwarded to the Germans. There's no way you can win. There's no way. They're just the Soviets are just going to fall back and fall back and fall back and fight back, and this is going to last forever. Okay, and it is as it is, and this is the moment where the Japanese tell to the Germans,
it's always a little easier to tell somebody else about their problems than to recognize your own problems. I mean, that's in life, but also in this, because if I remember right from Noman Han, Japanese intelligence. I mean, the one intelligent thing you could say about them is they realized they got whooped and they said no more of this, screw this, you know. But their intelligence was bad at going into it, right?
Yes, but the thing is, one thing you can say about Japan is the fact that they were not everybody, but the Navy. Okay, let's forget, because this is something from the Navy. Yeah. It's the naval intelligence that is doing all of this. And the Japanese Navy had a very good picture of what's happening in China. They would say, we are in a quagmire. We will never win against Chiang Kai-shek or anybody else or Mao, whatever. Okay, it is something we need to have a political... we need some kind of political decision on that. And this is the reason why we need to move against the America, because if we can knock America out of the picture, maybe we have the possibility to try to negotiate some kind of exit from China. Okay. And otherwise we are done. But absolutely, there is no way we can have themselves involved in this mess in Russia. And they tell the Germans. And the Germans at some point, at the beginning, they say, well, maybe you could help us there. And then is Hitler say, no, well, maybe if they are going against America and Britain, they're going to keep them busy somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of have some breathing space. So when Pearl Harbor starts, it's for Germany is some sort of relief. Well, we bought some time before they can, you know, go for our back. That is will eventually happen in 1943. So they are both something like 18 months of breathing space.
Right.
So it's not bad, completely bad news, but still is the fact that half of the land lease transport comes through the Pacific, right under the nose of Japan. Who just say, oh, you know, you cannot really transport these things unless it's food. It is food. oh yeah, okay, no, you go. It's very Japanese from this point of view. Okay, so I'll repeat something I said in the last episode, then I will add a new information. As I say, this is the moment where there are these you don't say moments in the German army. One of these you don't say moment is when a German demographer, comes out with this incredible insight that is, okay, so Soviet Union has twice the population of Germany, and so this means they can raise twice the number of division. I say, wow, it's you're a genius.
Yeah, yeah, that's a funny one.
This is incredible. But it's at the same moment, the head of Germany intelligence, military intelligence for Russia, is someone who has absolutely zero experience on intelligence, doesn't speak a word of Russian, and knows nothing about Russia. Okay, so the right person you can put to do this job. And
this guy would get a think tank job in D.C. as a Russia expert right away. But yeah, I didn't expect to be the head of. Is this Reinhard Galen or is he come in later?
No, he's coming later. Okay. He's the first. Okay. He's the first guy. Okay. Yeah, Reinhard Galen come. And Galen is.
Yeah, that's a whole new story. Yeah.
Okay. We're not talking about James Bond. Okay. And. Yeah. So they are continuing to make wrong assessment about the number of troops that can be generated and the number of tanks and the number of everything. Everything is just wrong. The only thing they are very good at is to having a clear picture of what is happening on the front in the first 50 kilometers. And this is the reason why they are initially very good on Typhoon. Typhoon is actually an impressive endeavor. Typhoon is the single largest operation ever attempted by Germany with a single commander. Okay. Mm. Army Group Center becomes a giant of 1,800,000 people, 1,500 tanks, three panzer groups. It's huge under a single command, Fyodor von Bock. Okay. And this decision is that to have three panzer groups put together in order to try to strike a triple. What is a three-pronged assault toward Moscow with Panzer Group 2 going from Bryansk in the direction of Tula, and then having one part of Panzer Group 2 going toward the Don and Voronezh. Panzer Group 2 under Guderian. Panzer Group 4 aiming directly toward Moscow. And Panzer Group 3 going from the north, from around Vyazma, and toward Moscow from the north, around Moscow from the north, and toward Kalinin. Mm-hmm. The now it's called Tver, I think Tver. That's the name. Uh-huh. Tver, exactly.
T-V-E-R, Tver.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
There's an interesting connection with Philip K. Dick in that sense, and I forget which novel it is. Where this guy is gifted or cursed with very limited clairvoyance. That is, he can see exactly what will happen 3 months from now or something like that. And
the World Jones...
the World Jones Made?
World Jones Made, maybe.
Is that it?
The World Jones Made.
So when you can see at a particular point that, wow, the invasion is going great. We're yeah. kicking ass.
Yeah.
But then later you have to face some rather grim scenes, such as the ones where this clairvoyant is, say, 2 months away from his death, and he is now seeing the world when he is dead. And it's not nearly so happy.
Yeah. Call the invasion off. Go on.
No, but it's more or less, it's similar. It's a similar thing because typhoon is something where this idea, we have this gargantuan collection assembly of firepower and people with all the problems of the German army. So the tanks are, you know, very quick and the infantry is very slow. And we are at the beginning of October. Rasputitsa is the rainy season, the mud season is very near. So the time frame they can use, the time window they can use for that is very limited. But they say, well, we go, we crush the front, and then we will decide. It is not a complete plan where every step toward Moscow has been planned in advance. It's, we break, we destroy the troops that are in front of us, and then we will see. But it's,
is that not normal at all? I'm just curious.
No,
like,
no,
in warfare. No. Okay, yeah.
It's normal for the Germans.
Yeah.
It's the way.
Do they call that initiative taking, like, yeah, like decentralized initiative?
There is this myth that been around for ages, and I thank God right now this myth has been considered and questioned about this idea that the recipe for victory of the Wehrmacht was this autonomy. The Panzer group had. They say that we are going to give you the intent of the command and then decide
right.
how to do things. The reality was that most of this was just insubordination by people who were pursuing this idea. I need to conquer the next big city in front of me because this is going to give me points for the world championship, as I told you. It was like that. I'm not exaggerating. It's people say, I need to go to Kalinin because if I conquer Kalinin, is a new...
Or I
want to go in the direction. There is this thing about Hoeppner that is convinced at some point in September, if I remember. Yes, in September, that is going to be the one that is going to conquer Leningrad. And he doesn't think, how are you going to conquer Leningrad, considering that the German army has a well-established record of being absolutely miserable on conquering city with tanks, okay? Mm-hmm. They had problems back in Warsaw in 1939, okay? And right. Hitler was aware about that. It was Hitler who forbade to the army to use tanks inside cities after the experience on Warsaw and Kyiv. So it was very unlikely they were going to use tanks to enter Leningrad. And by the way, the plan for Moscow was never to storm Moscow. It was to surround it and making starve, okay? To have people dying there of hunger. And again, this was semi-delusional because experience did demonstrate that starving those large Soviet cities was not as easy, particularly because encirclement very rarely could be kept as tight as people thought. There would always have been some kind of counterattack, some kind of porosity. So it's dubious they were really thinking about storming Moscow. But still, what they
Leningrad was a little easier to do a siege on a block, you know, a starvation blockade, just because of, well, you had Finland right next door, and the Finns were eager to participate in that, and just the geography made it a lot somewhat easier to have that encirclement. But Moscow's massive.
Yes, but still they never manage to seal it tight.
Right.
They managed to make sure the life for the people stuck in Leningrad was miserable. 1 million people died of starvation and so on and so forth. But it was never close as capitulating, because they really thought, oh, they are going to capitulate. Mm-hmm. And as you say, Moscow is enormous. So it was, and was well, much better provision for sustain a long blockade than Leningrad was. Well, whatever is the idea. They started, Typhoon starts with these two giant pockets in the south, Panzer Group 2 with Guderian, break the Bryansk front, and then, of course, again, as in Smolensk, Guderian say, I'm not going to bother for helping closing the pocket that is forming around Bryansk, and so I'm going to drive all the way to Tula, because he's obsessed on conquering Tula, because he thinks Tula may be the staging point for the final drive of Moscow, you know, like Yelnya in Smolensk is the same kind of reasoning, and you will never get to Tula, by the way. And then at this point happens this episode where first tank army future commander Katukov, General Katukov, Soviet General Katukov, ambush the units of the second panzer group and destroy them. Dozens of German tanks are destroyed near Mtensk. Because it's the first time the Soviet deployed their new T-34 with the 50 millimeter high velocity cannon, and they are using super caliber shells, and they are doing the ambush is very well done. So, you know, losses on the German side start to, just after 2 weeks, 10 days of triumphant march, they start again to pile up, and the second Panzer Group is going to be slow to a crawl. And the same thing happened more or less, even on a bigger scale, with Panzer Group 4 and Panzer Group 3 in the north. They closed the huge pocket near Vyazma for Soviet armies led by Ivan Konev, that is going to become later a very famous Soviet military commanders, are trapped inside this giant pocket, hundreds of thousands of people trapped there. And there is this thing, very interesting thing, that the Soviet decide to save and evacuate the green units that are not yet ready to fight and leave the veterans there. And this seems to be counterintuitive, because one may think, well, probably I would save the valuable unit to fight another day and leave the green unit there as a cannon fodder. But actually the idea is that the damage the veteran unit can do inside the pocket is much larger than the, you know, the green unit that militia units that are being retrained can do. The militia units are used, are moved around Moscow, around this defense line that's centered near a place called Mozhaisk. And they're going to defend there. There is a multiple line of defense there. And the pocket of Vyazma is another, in theory, enormous Soviet defeat, and this is the moment where the Soviets are, in theory, are having a manpower crisis, because they have reservists, but the reservists are not in the right place, are not in front of Moscow, so they need to buy time. And the time is both by the reduction of the pockets, reducing those pockets with the panzer generals who have could not be bothered to turn the tank around in order to close those pockets and destroy them, means that the infantry is going to do that. The panzer are moving, and they're moving all over the place. Again, there is no plan. There is no general plan beyond destroying those forward unit. So what happens is that Panzer Group 3 decide to go to Kalinin, Motivier, and they, because, you know, there is this obsession, I'm going to conquer Kalinin, I'm going to, you know, another point for the championship, and they are convinced that they are going to exploit a breakthrough north west of Kalinin, in the back, sorry, yes, northwest of Kalinin.
Again, just for people, Kalinin is north, whatever, it's north of Moscow, well north.
Northwest of Moscow.
Yeah, northwest.
On the Volga.
Yes.
On the Volga.
Right,
the
northwest Volga. Of Moscow, and Tula, again, is pretty much directly south of Moscow. Tula's exactly. famous for the samovars, but also had a large armaments industry.
Precisely. Yeah. And so there is this idea, okay, what we do after we won these, we need to go for Moscow. Oh, yes, we go for Moscow, but so we divert important reserves to go for Kalinin, because maybe we can use Kalinin as a starting point to cut, to go all the way to the north and try to cut Leningrad east of Lake Ladoga, which doesn't make any sense. If you check a map, you're going to see, I mean, it's hundreds of kilometers
north. The distances are insane.
Are
these guys, go ahead. Is this all the personal initiative thing again? Are they, defying Hitler?
Yes, Von Bock Von Bock knows that the Rasputitsa is going to come, and he tries to have a coherent plan in order to try to do something encircling Moscow. But this Getty, part is the initiative of the commanders that they decide what are the objective. I want to go to Kalinin. No, I want to go to Moscow. I want to go to Tula. At some point, there are this idea, I want to go to Voronezh, all the way to the Don, which is
way
again,
south. Yeah.
Way south. Yeah. And on the one side. On the other side, the OKH, Halder, and the bigwigs at the upper level, they are having all this idea about giant encirclement around Moscow, and God knows how they can do them. And when the Rasputitsa come, the mud season comes, everything is go down to a crawl. And they just have to say, we hope that the ground is going to freeze in order to start the operation again. And you will see the common sense response to that is, you are down, you're really, really worn down. Okay, the attrition is terrible. The logistic is in tatters. The Rasputitsa made any kind of travel going back from the railhead to the front line back and forth make almost impossible. The every day that pass, the Soviet becomes stronger and stronger because they are having time to bring forward new reserves from the Far East in order to defend Moscow. You should go to the defense. And nobody think about that. They will say after the war, they will come, they will tell everybody in their memoirs, oh, we wanted to go on the defense after the closure of the two pockets, Bryansk and Vyazma, two twin pockets, they are called. But the reality is that they want to push forward because they are blinded completely by the idea that maybe they can conquer another city, maybe they can, another wall to break, and maybe after this wall will crumble down, we will have operational freedom. And this operational freedom never happens. But you see that the whole thing is based on a delusion. It's completely delusional. And I want to close
down. I want to say something here before you close off then. That when your ideology, it's so deep, both through the military thinking and then through Nazism, is that will... you know, will and initiative overcomes all, especially Untermensch. And you have that as your guiding ideology, and you're facing banal problems like, you know, attrition, equipment wearing down, logistics problems. And then of all things, the Rasputitsa, which is months of, it goes, you know, rain, turning everything to mud. And then that'll happen for a while. And then you'll have a snow. And it'll freeze over a bit, and then it'll turn to slush, and then rain again. And so, and it just goes, it's all over the place. And that can go on for God knows how long until suddenly you get hit with just a brutal cold. Like, they just, you could see that these conquerors of Europe did not want to believe that such mundane things could get in the way of their genius initiative. It's just
the point I wanted to make. You absolutely nailed it. You did anticipate precisely the point I wanted to make. this is exactly that, you know, that to sum it up, this is the triumph of the will. This is the defeat of the will. Because yeah. It's this idea that magical thinking, and you will see these in the writings of these people, not the writings after the war. The writing after the war is just propaganda to try to, you know, create a new image of themselves for the new masters. Okay, NATO, US, UK, or whatever, or West Germany. But you see, the writing during the war is this idea: is that the will, my will, and projecting my will upon my soldiers, we are can do anything we want. The sky is the limit. You know, everything is possible if you just wish for it strongly enough.
If you will it, Hans, it is no dream.
Exactly. But it's incredible how New Agey is the whole thing is. But in the end, it's all irrational. It's not based on rational, cold calculation of the probabilities. It's just based on the idea, I am a golden boy, a wonder boy, the product of the best civilization that ever happened. So I have the moral duty to impose my will over this goddamn Russian weather. Because in the end, it's like this. If I wish the sun and the road being good, strong enough, my panzer will magically fly over this mud.
I mean, you know, one theme that was really developed in your episodes on Barbarossa, but also some of the other battles, is really giving lie, at least in military terms, to our general conception of Germans, German elites or German society as driven by efficiency, planning, cold calculation. Like, these are just a bunch of romantics, basically.
Yes.
Going, my inspiration. I feel inspired. I can take Tula. I mean, and they got away with it for a while for a variety of reasons. We won't get into it here, but they got away with it, which validated their sense that my initiative, my will, my inspiration is all we need to conquer and take everything. But it really goes against the view of what we can learn from German, military genius.
This is a great point, because the idea is, of course, these people had, assets, huge assets, because they killed millions of Soviets and they conquered a huge space in 1941 that they managed to lose in the next 4 years. But I mean, 1941, at least for some moment, look at like they were unstoppable. But the whole thing is that if you check the numbers, if you check the hard reality of what they were doing, if you check at the battles, if you see the reality of combat in World War II, you're going to see that they were very efficient at the tactical level, because they have this kind of standard operational procedure they could use at the company, regimental, divisional level, that did work on a series of, prerequisites, let's call it like that. But once those prerequisites were not there, there was nothing they could do, because at the operational and strategic level, they knew nothing about it. They absolutely no idea how to run an operation. The people could do combined operation inside, second Panzer Group could do combined operation inside the second Panzer Group, but God forbid that they could do operation with the other Panzer Group because they were in competition one of the other. They were not trying to. They seemed like Napoleonic generals trying to outmatch, outwit themselves in order, to conquer the favor of Napoleon. And probably Napoleonic generals were smarter than that. Mm. Okay. Yet in this case, there is this complete lack. And this has been, and I really want to close this episode with this, with this insight. There is this idea how they did project on the post-war generation, particularly the post-war mm-hmm. generations of military enthusiasts, this idea of the battle as a game, more or less balanced game, where, you know, as I say, the will, the sensitivity to the condition, the whim of a commander can decide things. While if you take a hard look at World War II combat, more, I mean, we may discuss this in a future episode, but more often than not was, do we have artillery? Good. Mm-hmm. Do we have a very good artillery spotter and a clear view of the enemy position? Good. Okay, I'm going to win. There is a, not bold maneuver or mm-hmm. a smart action or the kind of things you're associated with people like Rommel or Guderian. It was, you know, the presence of cold mm-hmm. elements of firepower, ability to have aerial reconnaissance, ability to have close air support. Fuel, the ability to have mm-hmm. fuel, you have stockpile and now fuel. And Typhoon did start with not enough fuel to arrive to Moscow, period. That's it. That's insane. So how can you imagine to win a battle if you are not, because you think that maybe the weather is not going to be so bad. Maybe I can have the Rasputitsa this year. You read things like that. You read people say, well, maybe we're going to have another couple of weeks of sunny, warm weather and dry. And say, no, well, normally the Rasputitsa is going to start. Every year is not going to make an exception because you are decided to do, military tourism in Soviet Union in 1941. That's the point.
That's insane. And, you know, we did an episode again on Germany, how they lost World War One, and they made just some insane assumptions. Very badly, stupid, insane assumptions then to us, not just the Nazis. I mean, I think this is, again, one of your points, that this is actually Wehrmacht and this is, you know, command, like senior command level, officer level. And I think this is all going to be relevant again. I'm going to leave it at this, but I think it's all going to be relevant again because Germany is remilitarizing. That is happening. And it's probably, you know, it now is not so popular in Germany, but they're pouring huge amounts of resources, money, propaganda into the remilitarization. And it's probably going to happen. And it's useful to know what the German military was really like, you know, at its peak and before its downfall. So I really appreciate this part 7 entry into Operation Barbarossa. This was part 1 of Operation Typhoon, which is the battle for Moscow. And so the next episode, I guess we'll get more into the actual battle. It's an amazing battle full of anecdotes and so on. So we'll save that for the next entry. So that wraps it up. Thanks again, everybody. John had to leave towards the end there, but I'm amazed and so happy that he lasted as long as he did. And he's going to be back at Radio War Nerd. So that's great news going into 2026. Anyway, thank you again, everybody. Thank you, Anibale. Thank you, John, Brendan, and for all of our supporters. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.